everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to take a look at the questions surrounding vaccines. Are they safe? Are they effective? Are the policies of mandatory vaccination in New York and California and about to be in other states? And then I've already read a bill out of California that they want to have mandatory vaccines on adults. What if every American, bar none, with no exceptions, every man, woman, and child, no matter what their age or state of physical or mental health, were mandated, you must take all your vaccines? And then it was seen that there are hundreds of vaccines in the pipeline, about 262 being developed right now. And they decided that all 262 vaccines would be in your body, and there were severe repercussions if you chose not to. You couldn't travel. You couldn't go to work. Think that's too draconian? Think it's too fascistic? Did you read today's New York Times headlines? We're already there. It's just a matter of enough people not doing their homework, being intentionally ignorant of the topic, including and most importantly the professionals. I'm absolutely disgusted beyond your imagination with our entire professional class. I'm talking about medical doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and scientists, because they're the ones who have the understanding of science, basic public health science. They're all involved in it, and they can certainly read the scientific literature. They could do homework if they chose to. They could become aware, and yet they're not. Equally culpable is the American population. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, there was a speech given by a young activist, 16-year-old, Greta Thunberg, at the United Nations. She was filled with anger, rage. She raged against the establishment. She didn't rage against Democrats or Republicans. She didn't rage against corporate America. She raged against anyone who was old enough to know that they should be doing something for those who are too young to know everything and don't have the wherewithal to make the changes. But she's trying. She's a vegan. She has a consciousness, and she's trying to get people motivated. The New York Times reported it fairly and accurately, as did most of the mainstream media. Today, however, one day after promoting the several million people in the United States who went on that march and protested, how many of them actually go home and try to convince their parents they should go vegan, start planting trees, stop buying excessive things, start looking at how they go from point A to point B, where their food is grown, a lot of things they can do on an individual level, and I'm sure that those messages will be shared. But today, the New York Times decided, instead of also honoring the millions of women and men whose children were vaccinated and end up with complications, including death, and instead of showing any empathy for them, since they went home after their children were no longer normal after their vaccinations, and they began to do their homework after the fact, but still. Now, I've interviewed well over 1,000. I produced 3 films on the subject of vaccines, actually 4, and have written 41 articles with Richard Gale, our scholar in research, in our office. And we have found that some people like Dr. Tony Bark, Suzanne Humphreys, and Nancy Banks and others have spent more than 15,000 hours researching 2 simple points. Are vaccines safe? Are they effective, individually or collectively? And they have come to the decision only after the research that they're neither safe nor effective for any given child, and certainly there's no science whatsoever looking at combinations of these toxicoids going into a person's body. So we looked at over 1,000 articles in the peer-reviewed literature on the immune system and on what could harm it in toxicology. We've interviewed in depth professors of toxicology, and they're just amazed at what is allowed to go into a person's body. Does the New York Times honor those victims? No, it condemns them. The World Health Organization said if you question vaccines, no matter what the reason for your questioning them, you are the problem. You're preventing good science from dictating herd immunity and therefore protecting the rest of the people who have been vaccinated and are good citizens. You're a bad citizen. You're a bad person. And the Washington Post has gone so far in its editorials to suggest that people that challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines should be arrested and imprisoned. Would that include enhanced interrogation? So where's the Me Too movement about the women who've been abused by the system, lied to, and betrayed with devastating effects? And where's the We Believe Her movement? And where's just Congress? Where are the state legislators? Where's the media? Where's the scientific community? Where's the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service? To address this issue today, we have some specialists online. We have Dr. Alvin Moss from West Virginia, my home state. He's a professor of medicine and physician scientist at the Major University School of Medicine and is the founding director of the University Center for Health Ethics and Law. He is here speaking with us as a private physician and not representative of any institution. Dr. Moss has published over 150 scientific articles in the peer-reviewed medical literature and serves on the editorial boards of the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology and the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. He is also a reviewer for the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and the Annals of Internal Medicine, and multiple other journals in medicine. He has directed and taught medical ethics to medical students for 25 years and has chaired the State Network of Health Ethics Committee for 30 years. Dr. Moss's interest in vaccine safety and vaccine injury was first prompted by ethical concerns of conflicts of interest in vaccine research and public policy. And as a practicing physician, he prescribes vaccines to patients who choose to receive them only after informed consent discussion. Therefore, he is not ideologically pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine, but rather pro-health, pro-ethics, and pro-informed consent about vaccination. He has testified multiple times before legislative committees as an expert on vaccines. And finally, Dr. Moss is a graduate of Harvard University and University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He is joined by Kevin Berry. Kevin is a former federal attorney in the civil law at the U.S. Attorney's Southern District of New York office and currently the president of First Freedoms, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution's First Amendment. He is also a representative of a NGO, meaning non-governmental organization, advancing global health and environmental literacy to the United Nations. Either Kevin was the president of the Jeannie McCarthy organization, Generation Rescue. He has three sons, one with autism. Kevin is the author of Vaccine Whistleblower, Exposing Autism Research Fraud at the CDC, with a preface by Boyd Haley and forward by Robert Kennedy Jr. And the book provides an original transcript of conversations between the CDC scientist and whistleblower William Thompson and Professor Brian Hooker about CDC's corruption and cover-up over vaccine safety. His website is firstfreedoms.org. I'd like to thank both of you for being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, the volatility of the debate, pro-vaccine advocates and their opponents over vaccination mandates and the removal of religious and philosophical exemptions rests on the reliability of the science that argues for or against vaccines' efficacy and safety. Therefore, I would like to begin by asking each of you a question. What, in your estimation, is the greatest weakness in the scientific claims that are given to rationalize the benefits for removing vaccine exemptions and mandating the vaccination schedule? Dr. Moss, we can begin with you.
It's funny, Gary, I just actually wrote a list of 20 weaknesses in vaccine science, and I think the biggest weakness is really the vaccines have never been safe safety tested against a saline placebo control. So we have no idea of what the true adverse reaction rate is. I'll just give you one example. So GlaxoSmithKline wants to bring out a new MMR vaccine, and there was an article just this March comparing the MMR 2 that Merck has with this new vaccine that GlaxoSmith wants to get approved in the United States. There was no control group that was a placebo control group. There was just one vaccine against another vaccine. 10% of the healthy children, you had to be healthy in the study, in both groups went to the emergency department after vaccination. 3.4% developed a new onset chronic disorder like diabetes or asthma or eczema. So we don't truly know whether or not these vaccines are safe. And I think that's the biggest problem. And when people start talking about the science is settled and we know that vaccines are safe, there isn't a single vaccine that's been appropriately safety tested against a true saline placebo control. And I can get into lots of other issues as well, but I mean, there's just not the basic science there. For the FDA to approve a drug, not a vaccine, but a drug, it has to be a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled study. And people think that vaccines are tested the same way, and they're not.
I appreciate that insight. Let's go over to you. The same question for you also, please.
Yeah. I'm going to paraphrase something that Dr. Moss wrote for an affidavit in the legal challenge to the New York religious exemption repeal. It's the concept that an unvaccinated child is a danger to anyone. That I think that's the biggest weakness. And as Dr. Moss points out, there's always this this fear of the immunocompromised. Who's a danger to the immunocompromised? And it's a little bit counterintuitive because of the way vaccines are marketed and there's very effective brainwashing. But the idea that an unvaccinated child is a danger to an immunocompromised child is backwards. The actual danger to the immunocompromised child is the child who recently got a live virus vaccine. So if a child got an MMR vaccine and was in a classroom with an immunocompromised child, the child who has the MMR vaccine, who may be shedding it, is more of a danger to the immunocompromised child than the unvaccinated child. And that's a simple concept, but most people don't understand it.
I'd like to go a little further with that, please. Would you add that if this is in fact a medical experiment being enforced upon humans, then what you see is the primary faults or even crimes of the government and these drug companies in perpetrating this experiment. And then secondly, you came to Italian Citizens Assistance by filing a human rights complaint against Italy for its mandatory vaccination laws and then again against France. Can you do that in the United States with any hope of success? And what are the major obstacles for filing human rights violation claims against mandatory vaccine? Because from my perspective, and I've spent 20,000 hours doing the research as a scientist, I cannot find where the vaccines would not be considered anything but experimental. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, it is. I agree with you that it's experimental, and it is a challenge to file the human rights complaint, and I did do it against Italy, and that's on the firstfreedoms.org website. That complaint became moot because Italy changed its government and changed its vaccine policy. But the problem with a lot of the UN declarations, like the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights, that is the gold standard, and it says that the rights of the individual take priority over the interests of science or society. It's clear as day. And it says that informed consent can be withdrawn by any person for any reason at any time without disadvantage or prejudice. And that obviously being held out of school is a disadvantage or a prejudice. So it's a clear human rights violation, but there's no teeth in it. So when a country violates it, there's not much we can do about it except shame them. You know, what I was trying to do with Italy is that there's a body in Paris that investigates the human rights violations as part of the UN. It would have been me and if it went further with a couple of medical professionals, and we would bring the country of Italy in to have them justify. They would have to try to justify what they're doing isn't a human rights violation, and they wouldn't be able to do that. The problem with doing that against the United States is, and I'm willing to try that if we have to, but it's right now it's not the whole country. It's states, so it's subdivisions of a country. So it's a question of whether you can bring a human rights complaint against all of the United States just because subdivision California and subdivision New York are violating human rights. I'll certainly try it, but I'm not sure if it'll fly.
Dr. Moss, back to you, please. The volatility on the debate, the pro-vaccine advocates, is that there should be no exemptions whatsoever. Let's put this in a broader context then. When you take a look at a person going into, let's say, a drugstore, and there's a sign saying, get your vaccination, the flu vaccine, whatever vaccine, and even UPS is doing home deliveries to give people vaccines, and in doctors' offices and hospitals and other places, there is not a conversation with a detailed history taken to see whether or not that adult, senior, or child has any condition, including autoimmune condition or disease condition, that would prevent a vaccine from having adverse effects. And yet when I look at the 45 paragraphs that are in the MMR vaccine given by the manufacturer, one of the very first side effects with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is measles. So shouldn't there be, at the very least, an in-depth conversation and an analysis to see whether or not the person is susceptible to side effects in the vaccines?
And as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that the Institute of Medicine, in report after report, has said that they recognize that certain groups of people have pre-existing susceptibilities to vaccine injury, and they've called on the CDC and the NIH to conduct research to try and better identify those individuals. But unfortunately, we don't know, except if maybe all three children in the family have severe vaccine reactions, we can conclude, well, there must be something most likely genetic about that family so that they have a pre-existing susceptibility. I'm afraid we just don't know. And so parents rightly are concerned if their child has had one vaccine reaction and the doctor says, well, I want to continue to administer vaccines. The parent is rightly concerned. And unfortunately, physicians have not been taught anything more than just what the vaccine schedule is and when you give them. And they've been taught that they're safe and effective and save lives. And they have not been taught how to diagnose vaccine injury and when to be very concerned that a vaccine may be contraindicated. Now, you mentioned before that you were born in West Virginia, and I practice in West Virginia, and West Virginia has one of the worst laws in the country with regard to vaccination, because basically you have to be vaccine injured to get a medical exemption in West Virginia. So even if you can be predicted because of a strongly positive family history, the thing that you were urging as you were asking me the question, shouldn't we be taking a family history? Shouldn't we be taking a prior allergy history? Shouldn't we really be determining if it would be safe to administer this vaccine? None of that is going on. Your only way to get a medical exemption in West Virginia is to have had a severe vaccine reaction to a previous dose of a vaccine, and then you will only get a medical exemption for that vaccine. And potentially, though, the formaldehyde, the polysorbate 80, the antigens, and the other vaccines that could trigger the same reaction, you're just going to have to find out if you're going to have a severe reaction to them, too. It's really goes against the whole idea that above all else, do no harm. As physicians, our goal should be not to take a healthy person and make them very sick with a vaccine that you can predict might run a high risk of doing that. And I'm very sad for my colleagues that they have not spent the time to actually look beneath the veneer that's being pushed by the marketing of the pharmaceutical companies, safe and effective, to look beneath that veneer to see that there are you know, that there are thousands and thousands of severe vaccine reactions a year if you look at the vaccine adverse events reporting system. So I won't go on. You know, we could just talk about how vaccine injury is underdiagnosed. People who are predisposed to vaccine injury cannot be identified in advance. And this is just a horrible way to practice medicine.
I interviewed the former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, MD, PhD, Mr. Kessler. And one of the questions I ask is, what percentage of adverse effects are actually recorded? He said at the best it would be around 10%. Our research shows it's closer to 2%. So when you look at how difficult it is for the average family member to comply with the federal government, and by the way, it's not just the federal government. When you are going up against a vaccine manufacturer, you never have to speak or see the vaccine manufacturer. The Justice Department and their very vigorous attorneys are the one that you have to go against, and they're notorious for being against the people. And still, almost $4 billion has been given out, including Hannah Pauling, that showed that her vaccine injury, including neurological damage and autism, it was stated autism in the final hearing. And yet one area of government will say there is no such thing as a connection between vaccines and autism. And another area of government is paying out rewards for just that same damage. And then you get the public that's confused. Well, who do I believe? I should be able to believe my pediatrician. I should be able to believe the government. I should be able to believe those who are lifetime career scientists at the FDA and CDC. And then it puts them in a conundrum because they're not going to be able to research the scientific literature easily. They're disinclined to do that because we're a conditioned society. As you just mentioned, doctors are also citizens, and they're also easily conditioned. And so then where does that leave the average person? Dr. Moss, back to you on this one.
Yeah, where does that leave the average person? I mean, it's a sad situation. Buyer beware. Do your research for yourself. Your physician may not have taken a special interest in this whole area, and unfortunately, some physicians are less knowledgeable than their patients about this whole area of vaccine science and vaccine injury and different genetic polymorphisms that predispose some people to vaccine injury more than others. You brought up Hannah Pauling and this case that was reported by neurologists at Johns Hopkins. And I'm just thinking about that case because in that same article, they reported that 47% of children being followed at Hopkins with autism had a mitochondrial disorder. And they thought that probably the mitochondrial disorder predisposed the children to develop autism from the vaccination. So that's an example of a pre-existing susceptibility, and we would need more studies to look for those types of genetic polymorphisms. But unfortunately, I was just reading how our country is spending billions of dollars on HIV research, but now we have 1 in 36 children with autism, and we're spending less than a tenth of that to try and figure out what's causing autism and why is the rate increased 250-fold since 1970. You know, 1 in 10,000 and now 1 in 36 or 1 in 40, depending upon which study you read. But, this is a devastating epidemic. This is a true epidemic, and we should be paying attention to it.
I agree. Barry, what's important from my perspective is, do we have the actual peer review, what is considered the gold standard in science, a double-blind placebo-controlled study where you take, let's say, realistically 5,000 children, cross-match the children for age, size, state of health. One group you give all the vaccines that are normally mandated on a one-year basis. The other group you give placebos, but real placebos, saline solution. You then measure these children's health outcomes and the metrics of how they're doing over a period of 5 years. Then you publish the results. I believe any responsible and reasonable scientist and public health official would say, great. But they say they've done that. We have placebo-controlled studies, so we looked at all of them, every single one in existence. And we found not one was a placebo with a saline. It was a placebo using another vaccine or an adjuvant like aluminum, which in and of itself is neurotoxic, so it's going to skew the results. Why are they not, since they have the resources and the federal government is willing to fund this as it does much of the research, why are they not looking to do this kind of study, to put this question to rest?
I think they're scared to death of what the results would be, and I think they kind of know what the results would be. And there has not been a large-scale vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. The usual excuse that the public health people make is that that it would be unethical to have unvaccinated children, as if there aren't already large pockets of unvaccinated children that they could study in the country. So there was a study a couple of years ago. Dr. Mawson did it in Mississippi. I think it was in Jackson State, where they compared some homeschool children who had a unvaccinated, partially vaccinated, and fully vaccinated group. And what they found is in the vaccinated group, it was 3.7-fold higher odds of neurodevelopmental disorders like autism or ADHD. It was five-fold increase in learning disabilities, 30-fold increase in allergies, increases in eczema, increases in other chronic diseases, increases in diabetes. So, again, that was a small study. There were only, I think, 700 children in it. And it should have been used as something to as a seed to explore whether or not there's a problem. And there's no follow-up. There's been no clamoring to follow up. And it's a giant mess. And I just want to throw one other thing in, you know, as Dr. Moss mentioned earlier about the marketing of the pharmaceutical industry and the lobby. I was down in West Virginia with Dr. Moss in June when there was a potential bill to get a religious exemption there. And I was talking with one of the leaders in the legislature, who is a physician himself, and pointed out, I think West Virginia is encircled, but it's either five or six states that border West Virginia, and all of those states have religious exemptions. And West Virginia knows it's very demonstrable that they're closing elementary schools because parents of young children who live near the borders of those other states, when their kids are ready for kindergarten, they leave the state. So I was saying to the legislator, who has the power to do something about this, is like, why are you encouraging people to leave your state? And he was kind of shrugging it off. Oh, there's a lot of reasons people leave the state. Same thing in New York this year, ahead of the bill that passed in June, talking in Albany to Democrats, saying, you have a 300-mile border with Pennsylvania. Why are you encouraging people to go across the border from New York to Pennsylvania, where they can have a religious exemption? They don't have it in New York, right? And it's mind-boggling that these policymakers are so bamboozled by the pharma marketing, by the vaccines or magic message that about safe and effective and don't scratch the surface. They are so blinded by that message that they are consciously encouraging people to leave their states. They're creating religious freedom refugees. It's mind-boggling.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you, Barry. I'll add something onto that from my own personal experience. Several years ago, one of my radio listeners contacted me and said there's an emergency that needs to be addressed. Tomorrow in Albany, they're going to be passing legislation that will make it mandatory for every healthcare worker in the state and every institution to have four vaccines, and all four contain 25 micrograms of mercury or 100 micrograms of mercury in a person where they can't work in a hospital, nursing home, any center. And there's been no debate. There's been no discussions, no public forum. So I asked my audience to join me, and the next day about 1,300 people showed up in Albany. We had signs, and we were demonstrating. We called the networks, and Fox, I think it was ABC showed up. And I had people from my audience. I said, I need you to get clean cut, get a haircut, wear a suit, bring a briefcase. And about 60 people did. And I gave them 110 pages of scientific citations by category, showing them where the vaccines that they were going to implement, this program, mandatory program, and the ingredients, none have been proven safe. And there was an enormous amount of side effect problems. So they went in and they got right in. The people must have thought they worked there, and that was the whole point. And they gave every legislator this packet of material plus a documentary called The Silent Epidemic about the politics behind vaccination. And so then they invited us in. Dr. Michael Schachter and myself were invited in to meet with the commissioners, and there were three physicians. And so they grilled us for about an hour. And every question they gave, we had multiple answers, and they saw they weren't going to meet that challenge. So then they canceled that and then held public hearings. And at the public hearings, then other people came forward, myself included. And interesting, because I was the first one there in the morning. I signed up, and by the way it goes, whoever's first, second, third, that's how you're selected to testify. I was first of all at 8 o'clock in the morning. They didn't allow me to testify until everyone left, the media left, at 8 o'clock at night. There was no one left. One person stayed, filmed that what I was doing, and then it went viral up on the internet. So I'm aware of the politics of this and also the science. That said, back to you, Dr. Moss, when you look at the entire rationale for mandating vaccines, it's based largely upon herd immunity hypothesis, the idea that if 95% or more of a population is vaccinated for an infectious disease, the disease will eventually be eradicated. And I will just take one example. Back in 1978, the CDC said that if 96% of school children received the measles vaccine, the virus would be eliminated by 1982. Well, they were wrong. Then in 2000, the CDC declared that measles had been eradicated in the United States. They claimed the vaccine had reached 98% compliance among school children. Again, they were grossly wrong. So if the herd immunity hypothesis is based upon false assumptions, then the entire edifice of laws mandating vaccines should be challenged. So please show us where the idea of herd immunity is false, or at least scientifically unreliable.
Yes. So I think the original idea comes from nature, when people acquired infections naturally, and then they had lifelong immunity. The problem, and it's a theory, and of course we know theories are just speculations about what might be true. The problem with the theory of herd immunity is that we're learning that there's something called primary vaccine failure, where even though somebody gets vaccinated, they don't develop antibodies, and so therefore they're susceptible to infection. And there's even much more we're appreciating now, secondary vaccine failure, what we call waning immunity. And studies are showing that as much as a third of the adult population, for example, may be susceptible to a measles infection, even though they were properly vaccinated as children, because they simply no longer have antibodies against the measles virus. And take it a step further, even if they were to get a booster as an adult, the studies show that the booster doesn't sustain, that after about 6 months, maybe a year at most, they're right back to where they were. So it's funny, just tonight I was reading the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that's put out by the CDC, and I came across the same thing. Three times in the history of this country, we've said, oh, we're going to eradicate measles, and three times we've failed, and we're right back at it now. All the scientists who are doing modeling are predicting we're going to have thousands and thousands of cases of measles in this country by the year 2050, because we're going to have all these adults with measles vaccine failure who won't, you know, generate an immune response to a booster, and this is going to be a huge problem. So herd immunity is totally flawed, because vaccines are not 100% effective, and they're just not going to be. Just to throw this in, people would say that's measles, but it turns out pertussis is another example of vaccine failure. And where they're now realizing, there was just an article earlier this year by a noted vaccinologist at UCLA who said basically anybody who got DTaP and was vaccinated with the DTaP for diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis, or whooping cough, they're now going to be susceptible to the rest of their life to pertussis. And they may or may not develop symptoms, but just like in the case of measles, they could still get infected and pass it on to somebody else, even though they may not clinically be showing symptoms. So I think there were 48,000 cases of pertussis in this country, I think in 2012, and there are 5,000 to 10,000 cases of pertussis or whooping cough a year in this country. So we have a real problem on our hands because we've abandoned the natural immunity that would have given us lifelong protection, and instead we have this waning protection from that's been artificially created by these vaccines, and they are not. In fact, let me just give you one more example of how this is this pursuit of herd immunity, which is a myth. This pursuit has actually left us more vulnerable. So with regard to measles, in the 1950s and 1960s. Things were such that when people had a natural measles infection, when mothers had a natural measles infection as a child, they developed lifelong immunity. And then when they were breastfeeding their babies and their younger than a year old babies, they were getting immunity from their mother through the breastfeeding. Well, that no longer is the case because the women who are vaccinated with measles now no longer have the measles immunity when they're in their 20s and 30s and attempting to breastfeed. So the babies are much more susceptible. And then the other population that's much more susceptible to measles when it's more dangerous are older people, people in their 30s and 40s and 50s, who because of waning immunity now are susceptible to getting measles, but they would have done much better if they would have gotten measles as a 3-year-old or 4-year-old or 5-year-old and would have had lifelong immunity. So actually there are many people who are very concerned that the current course of our vaccine policy in this country is going to ultimately end up in a disaster, and they're not the vaccine makers aren't going to admit that they've created this nightmare, and the CDC isn't going to admit that they've gone along with the vaccine makers, and they're of course going to just turn around and want to give more and more and more vaccines until this UCLA vaccinologist said they're going to want to give a Tdap shot every 3 years now to all adults to try and suppress pertussis. This is how crazy we've gotten, and it's even going to get worse, unfortunately.
Thank you. I appreciate those insights. Barry, I'd like to go a little further than our initial discussion on this. At this moment, as I explained, and you concurred, vaccines can be legitimately considered experimental and far removed from being declared as a settled science. If that is indeed the case, forced vaccination on the population without informed consent violates many international declarations and can potentially be interpreted as a crime against human rights. But extensions exist, and we could argue that physicians who then use the experiment are in fact engaging in a medical crime as well. Although certainly unintentionally, because I do not believe that any pediatricians or doctors who know enough about vaccine risks would intentionally make their patients susceptible. But the risks of many vaccine ingredients, such as aluminum, polysorbate 80, formaldehyde, the use of different animal culture tissues, and now these new nanoparticles being used continue to come to light. In addition, every vaccine has contraindications, and the scientific literature clearly indicates that there are far more contraindications that give sound reason for why certain people should not receive vaccines beyond what the drug makers' vaccine inserts or the CDC states. For example, a person's pre-existing susceptibilities to vaccine injury due to predisposing genes such as the MTHFR, which decreases the body's ability to detoxify itself from toxic ingredients such as aluminum or mercury. And there are other genetic polymorphisms which indicate a person should not be vaccinated. So, Barry, please put into context for us the negligence of these ingredients risks and which would strengthen the argument that vaccination continues to be a medical experiment. And finally, if you went into your physician's office and you received all the vaccines as scheduled, that is considered legal and acceptable. But if you went into that same doctor's office and you said, "Doctor, I want you to take that syringe of those vaccines and put them into a teaspoon so I can drink them or my child could drink them," the doctor would lose their license to practice medicine. And yet people are not aware that one of the reasons we do not absorb all the aluminum into our brain if we have an aluminum from a canned tuna fish or lead or any of these others is because the body has multiple mechanisms to help denature and degrade different toxicants before they can reach the brain. But when you put a needle directly into a vein, you're bypassing all of that protective barrier, and that never seems to come up in these discussions. Could you address these two issues, please?
Sure. I agree with everything you said, and it, of course, it's an absurd situation, but the unfortunate fact of the matter is there is liability protection all around. There's liability protection for the manufacturers through the 1986 Act. And because it's standard operating procedure, standard of care from the CDC, from the ACIP, from the American Academy of Pediatrics, from their hospitals policy, from their medical practices policy, it's very hard to get them to change because there are no consequences to their actions. But I'd like to just add one other thing that what Dr. Moss was talking about, the herd immunity and the 95%. This is what's important at all of these state, all of the mandates that are coming in are at the state level, and the exemptions, the religious exemptions are state level exemptions. And the pharma marketing team has convinced these legislators that they can get to the 95% herd immunity or community immunity thing, and you can't do it because the product sucks, because the product itself has a failure rate that greatly exceeds that 5%. So according to what Dr. Moss was saying in his affidavit, it can be as with primary and secondary failure, it can be as high as 30% failure rate. So aiming, you're aiming at this illusion, at this myth of a 95% community immunity through vaccination. So that's not real. That's a myth. What is real is the religious liberty of the citizen. You're taking away something real. What is real is the right to a free education in the public school. That's real. So you're taking away two real things. You're taking away religious liberty. You're taking away right to education while you're chasing a myth. It's the hallway that never ends. You can't get to 95% because of the product's own failure rate. That's what we're up against.
Barry, we're up against something, and I'd like for you and Dr. Moss to take your time on this one. We, I believe, have been misinformed with intent. I'll give you three examples, and these are real examples. These are not hypotheticals. These are not anomalies. We have seen with the Varistratin study that more than 200,000 subjects, kids, there was a statistically significant increase in autism spectrum disorders and other brain and neurological disorders. They were so shocked by this that they held a secret meeting that was not supposed to be recorded in any way at a Christian retreat center near the CDC headquarters. And the CDC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, and all of the vaccine manufacturers were present. There, as someone did record it, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. got a transcript under Freedom of Information Act, you actually see the people talking about this problem they've got. The problem is, how do we fudge the figures? How do we manipulate the figures so that we don't have to say the truth that there's a concern and some evidence that the vaccines can contribute to neurological damage, including autism? But they were successful. Then after that, Brian Hooker, who you both know, and I just spoke with Brian. Brian's own son was damaged. Brian is chairman of the science department at a university in California. He was asking for Freedom of Information Act documents. And under the rarest of circumstance, the head of that vaccine division that was Dr. William Thompson, and Thompson called him. And they had several conversations. And then after one rather disturbing conversation, Brian Hooker decided to record the conversation. So over the next nearly year, they had multiple conversations. In those conversations, because I have listened to the transcripts, I have read the documents, it is clear that he is acknowledging that, yes, in African-American boys, 36 months and younger, there was a 324% increase in autism spectrum disorder, but we had to hide this. And it went clear up the chain, clear up to the head of the CDC, which, by the way, is a military organization, and therefore you can't just make any unilateral statement or adjustment. You have to go through command positions. And he did. And then it was decided that all the people in that whole department would bring all their research files, and they took black garbage bags and destroyed them. Only one did not get destroyed, and that was Dr. Thompson feared that what if I'm involved in testimony before Congress, or what if this or there's a request for freedom of information on these documents, so he kept a copy. That copy, once it became clear that he had been recorded, he immediately sought whistleblower status and then turned those documents over to Mr. Posey, representative from Florida. To this day, years later, Posey's not been able to get a single hearing where the people, including William Thompson, the FDA, who acknowledged the cover-up, acknowledged a crime against humanity, acknowledge engaging in something that is a institutional racism. Remember, this is the same institution that for 40 years conducted the Tuskegee experiment, a shame upon that agency, where African-Americans were allowed to maintain syphilis, including tertiary syphilis, that could have been treated successfully, just like they were human lab rats. Let's see what happens to them. And they did this with these African-American boys. To this date, no one's been held accountable. The Justice Department, the Inspector General of the CDC, the Inspector General of the Justice Department, no one has looked to see whether or not they broke laws, which would then no longer allow them to be indemnified from litigation, since these were crimes that they committed. Now, there's two examples. I have more, but there are two examples. And then members of Congress questioned the very same people from that same department that engaged in these crimes, and they lied under oath. That's perjury. And we have all the people who testified and perjured themselves. So here we have a group of perjurers who engaged in cover-up, who hid the fact that African-American boys are going to have a higher incidence of autism, and got away with it. And yet, the New York Times, the Washington Post, who suggested an editorial that anyone who challenges vaccines, no matter the legitimacy of their concern, should be arrested and imprisoned, and the New York Times, along with the World Health Organization, considers anyone who challenges vaccine to be one of the biggest 10 top dangers in the world today. That's absurd. So our entire edifice, the entire progenitor of the vaccine movement, rests upon fraudulent science, corrupt scientists and bureaucrats within the CDC and the FDA, the World Health Organization, the vaccine industry, and we don't even mention any of this in our discussions or testimony. Dr. Moss, you first, and then we'll follow with you, Barry.
That's quite a tall order, Gary. I think what we're doing on this radio show is extremely important. People have predicted that we need to educate the public, and it's going to be the public that will finally rise up. And we've seen thousands of people in New York at the state capitol, thousands of people in Sacramento. This is going to have to continue, unfortunately, until there's enough of a number of people so that the legislators can no longer ignore the fact. And I think why this is going to continue to be a problem is more and more children are vaccine injured every year, and more parents are waking up and they're saying, wait a second, my pediatrician said it wasn't the vaccine, but I know I saw it with my own eyes. My child was fine. They were healthy. They were playing in the morning. They got their vaccine. They had a fever and then a seizure, and they've never been the same since. You know, how can you not say it's the vaccine? And parent after parent is saying this, and they have the same story, and they're all over the country, and they haven't talked to each other, and yet they are observing the same phenomenon. So I think we know. It's interesting. There's a former prosecutor in San Antonio. I think he was the former district attorney, Nico LaHood, who said, and he used to prosecute, and he said, if you have 10,000 eyewitnesses all reporting the same thing and they've not talked to each other previously, that makes it pretty believable that a crime has occurred. And I think we have a crime, as you've suggested. I think we have a crime occurring in this country. And because of regulatory capture, because the pharmaceutical industry has captured the FDA and the CDC, and we can no longer trust them to really look out for what's best for us, because there's capture of the American Academy of Pediatrics, because they pretty much just go along with whatever the CDC says. We're in a situation where, because of huge conflicts of interest at the CDC, we just no longer get the science that you were talking about earlier, vaccinated versus unvaccinated, true saline placebo controls, following people out long enough. You suggested 5 years. That would be great. Lipitor, a drug to lower cholesterol, was, you know, in those studies, those people were followed out for 5 years. On some of these vaccine clinical trials, patients have only been followed for 5 days. One of the hepatitis B vaccines, they only followed them 5 days. That's not near long enough to know what type of autoimmune adverse reactions you're going to get weeks or months down the line. So, you know, we really have to do what you're doing. We need to educate the public. We realize that cover-ups have occurred. We need to tell people, just don't believe whatever somebody else tells you. Research it for yourself. But the problem that we're dealing with is that the pharmaceutical industry is paying marketing firms, public relations firms, to just put out this information about safe and effective. They have their talking points. They're very effective. They're very good at what they're doing. And it reminds me of what people have called what the tobacco industry did. In 1953, scientific research showed that cigarette smoking caused cancer. And it wasn't until 1998 that the Surgeon General first put a warning on cigarettes. You know, they may be dangerous or hazardous to your health. So for 45 years, the tobacco industry managed to pay scientists to do studies to show, no, there's no, smoking does not cause lung cancer. So they were able to mask the truth until just enough of a body of evidence, you know, got out there. And I think that's what we're, many people are involved in right now. We're just hoping and praying that if we continue to be diligent, if we continue to check everything out for ourselves, if we continue to educate everybody else around us, that sooner or later, you know, we're going to reach the point, much the way we did with cigarette smoking and tobacco, where the public is going to wake up and the government is going to wake up, and we're no longer going to be in a situation where we're being forced to do something that's bad for our health. As much as, you know, people would like to say vaccines are the biggest public health miracle of the 20th century or whatever is the standard line, I think you and I know that they may not be. We don't have the safety testing to say that. And what we do have instead is, in 1980, 12% of our children had a chronic illness. In 2019, 54% have a chronic illness. It really looks to a lot of us like our children are a lot less healthy now than they were before we started vaccinating them. And when you look at other countries around the world, their childhood health is much better than ours. The United States ranks at the bottom of industrialized nations in measures of childhood health. So we're just hoping that enough of this information will sort of start to make a difference, and that more and more, honestly, more and more physicians, more and more lawyers, more and more broadcasters will be brave enough to speak out, because, you know, just like the New York Times editorial, we're marginalized, we're ostracized for speaking the truth about, you know, what's really going on.
Thank you. Barry, I'm going to give you the last word here, please.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Two minutes.
That's all I need, because Thank you. I agree with everything Dr. Moss said, and Dr. Moss wrote a great affidavit for the lawsuit that we're currently bringing. We're going to have a great opportunity next Monday in Western New York, in Steuben County Court, Bath, New York, where we're challenging the repeal law, the repeal of the religious exemption. And we're challenging it on a number of grounds. One, that the state constitutional religious freedom is stronger than the First Amendment. New York's constitution is from 1777, 12 years before the First Amendment. New York's Constitution says religious freedom is a forever right, and it's to all humankind. There are no broader words than forever and all humankind. The only condition on that is that it does not violate the peace and safety of the state. That's where Dr. Moss comes in, and Dr. Deischer and Dr. Pilevsky's affidavits and Dr. Moskowitz, because the measles cases in New York in 2018-19 were high, but 870 cases in a population of 20 million people is 4/10,000ths of 1%. It is not a public health emergency. No one has died. People had an itchy week, and now they have lifetime immunity. The only actual danger there is to Merck's future revenue stream. It's not a public health emergency. So we're going to be in there arguing that. We're going to be in arguing that the herd immunity is not achievable due to the product's failure, and we're going to be doing it to a judge, one person, not a legislature. Harder to get a judge to go dirty. So I think we have an excellent chance to draw like a first blow in the pushback against this ridiculous mandate thing in New York next Monday in Steuben County.
We wish you all the best. Kevin Berry, a former federal attorney at the U.S. Attorney Southern District of New York office, and he is the president of First Freedoms, and his website is firstfreedoms.org. And also, for the New York Times, if you think the only people speaking out are just uneducated and misinformed and vulnerable and susceptible parents who are delusional, Dr. Alvin Moss is a professor of medicine and physician scientist at a major university and a school of medicine. And he is also the director of the University Center for Health Ethics and Law. And he also has published 150 scientific articles in peer-reviewed medical literature. And he serves on the editorial boards of the Clinical Journal of American Society of Nephrology, the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, and a reviewer for the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Annals of Internal Medicine, and multiple other medical publications. And also, he is a graduate from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And by the way, he is not alone. There are at least 100 other physicians who have outstanding backgrounds and degrees who go at great risk. And therefore, in my opinion, he represents the new heroic physician activist in a society that needs it desperately. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs.